From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
96 billion pounds of food gets thrown out every year, which means that we throw about half of the food away in this country, and that translates to about 3,000 pounds every second.
That's dumpster diver Jeremy Seifert, who fed his pregnant wife and two-year-old son on food from the dumpster. Fighting food waste later this hour. Today we go back to the land again and hear stories about living closely with the natural world and what the back-to-the-land ethos looks like today. Take Melissa Coleman. Her memoir, This Life is in Your Hands, tells the story of her homesteading parents, proteges of back-to-the-land giants Helen and Scott Nearing. Here's a reading from her book.
As the bell chimed, Helen took my small hand and turned it upward in hers. The kitchen was warm, but her skin cool and leathery. Mama returned with Heidi as I stood, long hair braided and 6 years brave, holding my breath. We knew about Helen that when she didn't have something interesting to say, she changed the subject. She smoothed my palm with her thumbs and looked down, but also in, her cropped granite hair holding the dusty smell of old books. "What's this?" she asked of the marks I'd made with Papa's red magic marker. "A map," I told her, proud of the artistry on my fingers. "A map of our farm." "Pshaw!" She tossed my hand aside like an old turnip from the root cellar. So she read Heidi's palm instead. Heidi was a blue-eyed two-year-old, an incontainable spirit, everyone said. Even she held still, mouth open, breathing heavy, snug in the sling on Mama's back as Helen smoothed out her little fingers. "Short lifeline," Helen muttered, bending toward the light from the window, then paused as if catching herself too late. "What do you mean by short?" Mama asked, brown eyes alert, mother bird-like. 30, 40 years?" "Oh, it doesn't mean a thing," Helen said, and began to mumble about the overabundance of tomatoes in the garden. 7 years earlier, Helen had thought differently, perhaps, as she read my father Elliot's hands when he and Mama visited looking for land. Understanding the lines is an attempt to understand why things happen as they do. Also, a quick way to figure out who might make a good neighbor. Helen and Scott Nearing, authors of the homesteading Bible Living the Good Life, wanted young people around who would find the same joys in country living as they did. Their philosophy held the promise of a simple life far removed from the troubles of the modern world, the good life. "Very strong lines," Helen told Papa that summer of 1968. He had the deepest fate line she'd ever seen and wide, capable hands. Shortly after that visit, my parents received a postcard from Helen and Scott offering to sell the 60 acres next door. That's how we came to be back to the landers, living on a farm cut from the woods, without electricity, running water, or phone, on that remote peninsula along the coast of Maine, trying something different to see if truth could be found in it.
Sheila Shigley, reading from Melissa Coleman's memoir, This Life is in Your Hands. Coleman spent years of her childhood growing up in rural Maine with her sister Heidi and parents Elliot and Sue Coleman, who built their own house and planted their own land back in the 60s and 70s. Along the way, Elliot Coleman became a national figurehead for the organic food movement and remains so today. Coleman told Anne Strainchamps that their life was far from conventional.
We were completely off the grid. My dad and mom, before I was born, they built our cabin. Well, first of all, they had to clear the land. The land was treed, and they had bought this land from the Nearings. It was sort of a neighboring acreage, and they had to clear the trees, dig a well, and then they started to build this house, which was they built for $680.
Wow.
And yeah, with, you know, just hand tools. At first, my dad didn't even get a backhoe in or anything like that to help. He dug the foundation himself.
By hand?
Yeah, by hand, yeah, yeah.
So when you said they dug a well, did they do that by hand too?
Yes, yes.
Oh my God. Yep. Wow. Now, how did your parents come to this? Did they grow up with farm skills?
Not exactly, actually. My dad's father was a stockbroker in Manhattan. And my mother's father was manager of a bank. And so they grew up, you know, regular middle-class lives. And they'd, you know, gone to school. And, you know, my dad wanted to be a teacher. and my mother was in school at a college at that time when they met. And so they just sort of had this idea that they wanted to grow their own food. They were big food nuts. They wanted to eat healthy food. And they felt the best way to do that was to grow it themselves. And back then in the 60s and 70s, processed food was a miracle. It was sort of this new thing that was this great time saver. And so everyone was all excited about it, but they hadn't really thought about the fact that it didn't taste that good often and it wasn't always that good for you.
How much do you yourself remember about those years? You were little then.
People always ask this because, of course, I didn't remember everything in my memoir. I had to reconstruct it. But I did start with just some very amazingly powerful, strong memories from my childhood. I sort of collected them like this little treasure chest of things that I remembered, things from the smells and the sounds and the apprentices, things that they would sing to me or tell to me. And these were very strong memories from young age. And I think that had something to do with the fact that I was living off the grid in such a simple life. And there wasn't all those many distractions that happen in modern life of, you know, the TV and the this and the that. So these things were very, very clear for me. It was a quiet time in a lot of ways. I just recently started thinking about the poem Intimations of Immortality by William Wordsworth and how he talks about how in childhood, nature and everything seems so beautiful and so crisp and clear, and that as we get older, it starts to fade a little bit. And that's exactly what it was like for me. It just, everything was so clear and crisp and beautiful. And then, you know, we all lose that. But for me, I lost it in a sort of tragic way. And so I think that just put a big exclamation point on the whole idea of paradise lost that we all kind of go through as we get older.
Yeah. The tragic way is your younger sister died accidentally. Do you remember that day?
Yes, I do. And that is one day that I remember very clearly. I don't remember everything, and that was part of why I felt that I needed to write the book and sort of make peace with what happened. But I do remember just very, very clearly, you know, wanting to go down and find out what happened to my sister and the sort of chaos that ensued, and just being so completely shocked by such a thing happening. It was such a shock at that age in a world that seemed so safe and beautiful.
How old was she?
She was 3 and I was 7.
And what happened?
Well, my sister and I loved to play down by we had a little irrigation pond below the gardens, and it usually wasn't that deep. It was a shallow pond, and or around the edges, it was very shallow. And so we would play there, and we would catch frogs, and we loved to do that. It was not thought of as a dangerous thing for us to do. But that day, you know, the night before, it had rained a lot. There had been a lot of rain. So the pond had gotten much deeper, and the banks were slippery. My mother was trying to clean the house, and I was playing in the loft where I like to play, and my sister kept coming to us and saying that she wanted to play with me or for my mom to play with her. And we just, you know, as you do, we said, oh, I'm busy, or, you know, in a minute. And so she went off by herself down to the pond, and my mother was the one who found her down there at the pond, but it was too late at that point.
Oh. There was a terrible scene that night, too. To make everything worse, the local police showed up and they wanted to take your sister's body away to the local undertaker, but your parents refused. There was this sort of standoff.
Right. Well, my father, I think any parent, you know, the first reaction to something like this happening is a lot of anger. Just the thought that they were going to take her body away was more than my father could stand. It was sort of this procedure that the ambulance went through, and they were going to take her in. And, you know, in those days, the bodies get prepared, and as my father saw it, is getting put full of chemicals. And that was the last thing he wanted to happen to his child that he tried to raise so naturally. So he told them no. He said, no, I'm not letting you take my child. I want her buried here at our farm. Luckily, there was, a DA who was Jewish, and in the Jewish tradition, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, they want the body to be buried within 24 hours. And so he granted the permission to my dad to do that. So we were able to bury her on the land, and she's there today. I like to go visit her grave on the farm where I grew up.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Your childhood memories must be split into before and after.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it happens for all of us. You know, you start to lose that innocence of childhood as you get older. But that just kind of was like this big bam. And then after that, you know, my parents' marriage began to dissolve. And we left the farm when I was 9, so 2 years later. And then I moved to suburbia. You know, I moved to suburban Boston. And it was a big shock to sort of go from the life I was living to that. It just sort of felt like I'd lost so much wonderful beauty and connection to nature.
Well, it wasn't just your innocence, your sense of innocence that was lost either, I imagine, for both of your parents. There must have been a sense that, you know, here they'd gone back to the land to try to create and build the new paradise, and, you know, it had ended so terribly.
Exactly. I mean, I think you just never think that something would go wrong like that when you're trying to do something that you feel is so right and so wholesome. And what I think, you know, when I think about it, it was too much back then to try to do all that. It was very extreme, and it was the times to be so extreme like that. And today, it isn't quite as much of an extreme statement. Like, we had to go all the way to one side with the pendulum to kind of make this break. And today, I think people are able to live more simply. You know, they can grow their own food and have internet and have things that help them to just make their lives a little more easier so that they don't get pushed quite to that extreme. I mean, we were living like the pioneers were, and lots of things, crazy things happened like that to the pioneers. But today I don't see it as a cautionary tale, because I see it as a symptom of a time and a place. And today I see people doing, living like this and having their gardens and being able to balance it all in a way that is very sustainable and very, you know, it's you have that same beauty and that same connection to nature, and yet you're also sort of still part of the world in a way that makes life a little bit easier.
Well, how do you look back on the whole back to the land experiment now?
I look back on it as, you know, I just, despite all the things that happened and the craziness that, we were just talking about, I just see it as such an amazing, unique time in history that, you know, it's never going to be quite like that again. And, you know, people, like I was saying earlier, people today, it's just much more sustainable. And I see it as this time that had to happen, though. It had to, we had to do that. We had to go back to go forward. And, you know, the chemical agriculture industry had become sort of all pervasive, and it didn't have any challengers. So there needed to be this break that happened and this sort of crazy people that did it. And, you know, people thought we were really weird and really strange and really, it was challenging to the system, but those things need to happen. People, you know, if you're one of those people, I say go for it, and just, you know, you got to follow your heart. You got to do that crazy thing, because if we all just sit around being normal, the world is just going to become very boring. I feel like, you know, despite everything crazy that happened, what we did was the right thing to do, and I wouldn't change it for anything. And today, you know, I see the fruits of that, that you can go to the farmer's market and find organic food. There's health food stores. There's just variety in the food out there. And, you know, back then there was maybe one health food store in the state of Maine and one farmer's market. I really think it needed to happen, and I'm glad we were part of it.
Melissa Coleman lives in Freeport, Maine with her husband and twin daughters. She's the author of This Life is in Your Hands. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. You can listen to TT Books' archive of interviews with urban gardeners, homesteaders, and farm-to-table chefs on our website. Check us out at ttbook.org. Coming up, living the simple life in a simple house, 12 by 12 feet, in fact. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
It's an unusual night in L.A. because it's freezing outside. Freezing for L.A., so I think it's, you know, 43 to 45 degrees, which is good because it keeps all the meat and stuff cold and it's been dumped.
Oh, here's the meat.
No antibiotics ever. No added hormones ever. Free range.
It's good meat.
All of these perfectly good eggs because one was cracked. Didn't even get all over the other ones. Just threw them all away. This is what they're doing with everything. They have bags of avocados. One goes bad, they throw the entire bag of avocados out. Apples, oranges, everything. They're just tossing it for no good reason. They're all good. These are all good eggs.
A clip from director Jeremy Seifert's film Dive about feeding his family from Los Angeles dumpsters. With a rise in awareness about how food is produced and the resources required to feed the world, Seifert says it's time we reckon with the massive amount of food waste in America. He told Steve Paulson about the gastronomical treasures he's found in the trash.
Every kind of food you can think of, from organic free-range whole chickens to ahi tuna, baby broccoli, sourdough bread. I even found a 12-pack of porter beer, with one of them was broken.
So even if just one bottle or can is broken, they're going to throw out the whole thing?
It depends on the store and the situation. You know, if the employees can sneak it out, they probably will. But otherwise, yeah, they're going to throw it away. And you know, at a store like Trader Joe's, where they package up their tomatoes in plastic, four to a pack, if one of those tomatoes gets moldy, they consistently throw away the whole pack.
Now, I would think with some of this food, it would be fairly obvious whether it is beyond the edible stage. A tomato, for instance, I mean, you can kind of tell if it's rotting. With meat, that, I would think, would be much more complicated. How do you know if it's still good to eat?
Well, we had to learn a lot about food as we went on these dumpster dives because I was taking it home and feeding it to my wife and two-year-old son. So I wanted to be really careful. You know, the first thing is to look at the expiration date and make sure that they are, in fact, throwing it away the day before it expires so you know when it was thrown away, and we would always feel it and make sure it was cold, so we knew, okay, this has been thrown away within the hour or two. And then the other thing was to begin to trust my nose. I mean, you can really learn how to smell something and know if it's good or bad.
So do you go by the expiration date then? I mean, if you find, let's say, meat that is beyond the expiration date, would you not take it?
No, not necessarily. I mean, expiration dates, by and large, are pretty bogus. They're a part of a very paranoid, litigious society. And, you know, the producers and the markets trying to protect themselves and being overly cautious with the expiration dates. I mean, things are typically good a week or 2 weeks beyond the expiration date, especially things like yogurt and cheese and these types of things. And meat is as well. So a little brown in your steak actually can make it more tender.
The chicken was looking a little funky, a little like purplish.
Food makes up about 20% of landfill waste, which means we're feeding our landfills as much as we're feeding our country. So instead of rotting underground, packed beneath the earth and producing harmful methane gas, this garbage was feeding my family and friends, and doing it in style.
Well, this will be blood orange and onion salad with a tranchon of salmon stuffed with feta cheese and spinach rescued from your local dumpster and a beautiful blood orange citrus beurre blanc.
But if all this food is still edible, or at least a lot of it that ends up in the dumpster, why are the stores throwing it out?
I think that's the big question, and I think there are a number of answers for that. One, I think, is ignorance of the Good Samaritan law, which was put into being in 1996 under Bill Clinton, and that frees up food providers to give any and all food in good faith to food pantries, food shelters. Another, I think, is just that food waste is a bad habit born out of a society of excess. We all waste food. Every one of us, almost every day, because we have excess and we don't have to think about it. And the same is true for these stores. And then some of it is just laziness, that to take the time to set it aside, to keep it refrigerated if need be, and to connect with local food banks and food pantries is harder than just throwing it away.
You mentioned the amount of waste that we all do when it comes to food, even those of us who are pretty conscientious about it. Are there any numbers as to how much food we actually waste in the United States?
Well, the estimate for the United States is 96 billion pounds of food get thrown out every year, which means that we throw about half of the food away in this country. And that translates to about 3,000 pounds every second.
We throw away half the food?
Half the food, and that's the United States. Yeah, it is. And one of the studies that arrived at that number was just actually looking at the number of people in this country, the average amount of food that we could eat, and the amount of food that we then produce or import and have. And we can only eat half of it, so we do throw away nearly half of it. And a recent report came out that said that around the world, 30% to 50% of food is thrown out worldwide, which is approximately 1.3 billion tons of food gets wasted or lost.
Now, it's one thing to understand this at kind of this policy or intellectual level. It's another thing to actually go and eat the food that ends up in the dumpster. Why did you decide to do this? Why did you take this on for your own family?
It was a very simple reason. Some friends were visiting from Philadelphia and they brought over bags and bags of food and dumped it out on my kitchen floor. And they said, oh, didn't you know you can jump in the dumpster a mile down the street at Trader Joe's and get amazing food? And I didn't know. So a couple nights later, my friends and I went. And so we didn't begin this as any kind of social activism or to make a statement. We began simply because the food was there and why not go get it? But once you eat trash, it changes the way you see the issue and you awaken to food waste, and then beyond that to this issue of hunger and need in our country.
And the way you portray this in your film, it wasn't just the occasional dumpster dive, sort of supplementing what you would buy in the store. It sounds like most of what you eat, or at least ate during a period, came out of the dumpster.
Yeah, exactly. For a good 2 years there, probably 50 to 70% of our food was coming out of the dumpsters. And at the time, I had a 2-year-old son and my wife was pregnant. So I was definitely raising my family on trash, to put it crudely. But times have changed for us and dumpster diving in this area. The Trader Joe's stores in this area of the world in Los Angeles have really stepped up their food donation and made great connections. So a lot of the dumpsters have changed radically for the better.
Now, you've mentioned Trader Joe's a couple of times, which in a lot of people's minds is a very good corporate citizen and tries to provide good food at a relatively inexpensive price. And yet you say they are one of the big offenders in terms of dumping out a lot of still edible food. And in fact, you went and tried to talk to management, both at your local store and at the national level. At one point, you launched a letter writing campaign and got nowhere. Why are you picking on Trader Joe's?
I was originally picking on them because I love them, and they're my neighborhood, you know, my friendly neighborhood grocery store. And I was pulling a lot of food out of their dumpsters. And the biggest surprise for me was that they wouldn't talk to me.
Okay, so here we are at Trader Joe's Saturday afternoon. I'm going to go in and talk to them because I went to their website, and their website says that they prefer to talk face-to-face.
We're also not allowed to comment on anything in front of the camera. You know, it is.
Right. So none of the stores...
None of them will talk to you.
He's going to give me the card for the place I already called, which refused. So basically it's impossible to talk to anybody on camera. I mean, even off camera, they wouldn't discuss details, so...
I felt like, oh, I'll go into the corporate headquarters and tell them, hey, food pantries have empty shelves right now. This is 2008, the food crisis. You have a lot of food in your dumpsters. I think we can work something out here. And I didn't have a camera over my shoulder. I went in by myself. And they wouldn't talk to me about it. And I, endless phone calls. And then I started sending a letter to Dan Bain, the CEO, every single day. And actually, the first time they talked to me was after the film was made, and there was a story on NPR. And I was a part of that story, and so were they. And I called them up after that, and they were ready to talk.
Hmm. What did they say at that point?
The curious thing about that is that I went in and talked with Matt Sloan, the vice president of marketing, and I said, why am I talking to you? You're the vice president of marketing. Where's your sustainability person? He said, we don't have a sustainability person. I said, okay, well, that's your first problem. And since you did $8 billion of sales the previous year, I think you have enough money to afford that and take this more seriously. And they essentially responded with, we're going to keep doing what we're doing, but we're going to do it better.
Which means what?
Which is I don't know, that's rhetoric. They refused to adopt a corporate-wide policy to end food waste in all their stores. And I think they were scared of making such a big and bold commitment. And I was asking them to be a leader on this issue. And so they said, we're going to keep doing what we're doing, which is leaving it up to individual stores to make donations, but we're going to do it better. And from our pressure and, you know, different articles and interviews, they really have stepped up their food donations. So I'll give them a thumbs up on that. But we wanted them to go a step further and adopt a corporate-wide policy to end food waste. And we asked the same thing of Whole Foods and other grocery stores that don't have these policies in place.
Now, when you say you want them to donate the food to food pantries or shelters or something like that, how would that actually work? What would be the process where supermarkets could donate food?
The process is really simple and is happening, like I said, in many Trader Joe's in this area. And that's simply that the employees set aside all this food that's going to expire, or there's a bad tomato in a pack of four, or bread that's a little bit old, and they set it all aside, and they've made connections with local halfway houses, food pantries, food shelters, and they simply come and pick it up at a designated time every single day. And it's kept local, and that way people who need food can get good food and fresh food, not all this canned corn syrup USDA food.
And can this amount of food actually make a difference in these shelters?
I believe it can, yes, because grocery stores put out quite a bit of waste because we also live in a society that says we have to have everything all the time. And so stores have a burden placed on them by us, or maybe they've manufactured the desire in us. I'm not sure which it is, but you know, when you take an apple off that little pyramid of apples, some guy runs from the back of the store and puts another one on top because you don't want to see any half bare shelves in the grocery store. And because of that, there is a lot of waste. So I think it can make a difference in the hungry and the needy.
Jeremy Seifert is a writer and filmmaker from Los Angeles, California. His documentary is called Dive. Steve Paulson spoke with him. For some people, living closer to the land means figuring out what really matters in life, paring everything down to the essentials to see what remains. William Powers writes about that way of life, what he calls wildcrafting, in his memoir 12 by 12. The book tells the story of a woman he calls Jackie Benton, a physician who lives off the grid in a 12 by 12 foot cabin in rural North Carolina. Powers says he was looking at the consumption of America with new eyes when he found Dr. Benton.
I'd spent a decade working abroad in Africa and South America, and I just returned to the States, and I was a bit shocked. I've been living in sort of very low-impact societies that have basically carbon-neutral impact on the planet. And then to come back and to see my own culture and my own society, which was having a big impact on climate change and all the shopping malls and the parking lots and everything else, was a bit overwhelming.
You must have been looking for something closer to your comfort zone by then.
I'm not sure exactly if I was looking for it, but I certainly found it. I received a phone call from Dr. Jackie Benton, and I was invited to go out and visit her in her 12 by 12 foot house in rural North Carolina. And I went out there, and I've never in my life seen such a small house. I didn't even want to go inside. I felt like it was too small and almost like invading someone's privacy to go into such a small place.
I mean, to put it in perspective, most people would find 12 by 12 a reasonable size for a guest bedroom.
Exactly. It's well, I'm 6 foot tall, so it's two of me each way, basically. And in that space, this physician has everything that she needs. She lives out of this. There's no running water. All of the water is harvested off of the roof. It's rainwater. There's just a small stove inside to cook with. And there's a composting toilet and a beautiful permaculture farm all around it with a couple hundred varieties of native and heirloom plants that she grows to live off of. It's an integrated design of landscape and architecture to achieve sustainability.
Is that what you mean when you say permaculture?
Well, you might say it's the things that your grandparents knew but your parents forgot. It's basically living in harmony with the natural environment around you, being able to produce your own wines and jam, being able to grow the food that you eat, sometimes making your own clothes. Some of the homesteading ideas come into permaculture as well. So another definition is it's a sustainable way of designing architecture, the space that you live in, and landscape, the space around your dwelling.
And that brings us back to the 12 by 12. Now, we're not going to spend an entire time inside that building, but still, I'm sort of fixated on 12 by 12 and how you can live in a space that small. Most of us would find it impossible.
Well, you know, it's like Jackie says, and her name, by the way, is a pseudonym. She's asked for her privacy to change it. You know, she says that it's not that she's trying to convert people to living in 12 by 12 houses. You know, those are the dimensions of her life and her needs as a 60-year-old person whose kids are grown up. And she feels like she's got her material needs in line with what she's got. So for someone with a full family, obviously 12 by 12 is not enough. But the idea is to look for the elusive contours of enough and find the space between underdevelopment and overdevelopment. Much of us are in the overdeveloped space where we have too much, and that clutters your life, reduces your creativity, and is somewhat flattening.
Were you prepared for this when you went there for the first time?
You know, I certainly wasn't. As I mentioned, I was quite shocked to see this place, and in some ways repulsed by it at first, or threatened by it. You know, the idea that this was not some sort of a stunt or something like that. I mean, this person actually has lived for years in this 12 by 12 house with no electricity or running water out of pure choice. You know, I mean, she's a physician that could make lots of money and live wherever she wanted to. But instead, she only paid some $7,000 for the house. Her entire house is paid off, plus, I think, $10,000 for the land around it. So for $17,000, you're set for life, you know.
And you said that one of the reasons that she chose 12 by 12 was that by North Carolina property law is a shack, so it doesn't need to have taxes paid on it.
Right. It's not defined as an actual house if it's smaller than 12 by 12. Right. So it's, yeah, you don't receive any services from the state at all, but you're also not required to pay into the system for property taxes.
Wow. You had some experience of this, so you were more prepared than I would be, for instance, to think about this, and yet you were still put off a little bit about it until you went inside. And it felt bigger inside than out, I guess.
That's right, Jim. It was just amazing to feel the expansiveness and the spaciousness of the place when you get inside. She had her great-grandmother's rocking chair in there, which I sat in for several hours as the sun was going down outside. And she has a loft up top where her bed is and some bookshelves. And actually, there's really plenty of space there. You know, and what you also realized, and I lived there for a season while she was traveling, was that really it's about the space around it. It's about what you don't build. You know, it's the spaces in between are what are important. The spaces in between our thoughts, leaving a more expansive, creative beingness to our lives, but also in our environment, not creating too much stuff. Thoreau talks about this in Walden. There's a whole tradition in American history of embracing simplicity, you know, and that's really what it's about. It's about opening up spaces for ideas and relationships and inner growth to happen.
You decided to live there. You were offered the opportunity to live there for a season, and you took it. And in some ways, I suppose that gives you the opportunity, but also the necessity of discovering who you are.
That's right. That's a good way of putting it, that it's about taking away from the exterior environments a kind of an aestheticism that allows a kind of a more vivid and rich sort of inner world to take shape and form. And that's what I found. And I found that I was uncovering all kinds of emotions and thoughts and feelings that I hadn't before because I was always so busy. You know, I've spent 10 years abroad in these different countries working on development projects, ecotourism, how to export organic coffee from Bolivia to the United States, or how to do sustainable timber production in Liberia for export to the EU. All of these things take up, you know, really long work weeks. So really what it is this is a movement towards idleness. And it's what I call the idle majority. You know, there's a leisure ethic, not just a work ethic. And this leisure ethic is powerful. And, you know, billions of people around the world, I'd say maybe, you know, half of humanity expounds a kind of a leisure ethic.
Chris, for you, there was always knowledge that the future was not going to be here. You were not going to stay in the 12 by 12 forever. Did that figure in the back of your mind as you experienced all of this?
Yes, I knew that. And I think the only real test of an experience is whether it gets into your sort of habitual DNA, your habits. And I always kind of feared in the back of my mind that once I left this 12 by 12, that I would just go back to all my usual behaviors and nothing would change because I felt like I was learning an incredible amount. But I found that I did integrate a lot of what I learned out there into my daily life. And again, it's not like I live in a 12 by 12 house now, or I'm not living in a cave and eating roots and berries. I live in New York City, you know, and I ask myself, what's my 12 by 12 in my life? And I think it's a question a lot of people can ask themselves, you know, what's my 12 by 12? How can I find this space of harmony and responsible consumption and joy in life? So for example, for me in New York, I mean, it's kind of easy for me not to have a car because it's New York City and there's lots of transportation, but I don't have a car. And I grow some of my own stuff in my garden in the back, and steps like that that are creating a kind of a 12 by 12 space in my urban life.
How long were you there in the 12 by 12? Just one season, but what is it, a few months?
That's right. It was just 40 days that I was actually living out there.
Isn't it an experience you would like to repeat?
I would like to repeat it. But then again, it's, you know, the process for me was about how you find your own rhythm and your own self and your own authenticity. And I don't think really my place right now in the world is to become a recluse or a hermit or living on that kind of a radical stance. You know, she's really at the edge of how radical you can live in America at this point, I think.
Do you see this as possibly being a new American vision, a new American dream?
I think I do. I think that there's a movement towards the small and towards the simple. I mean, people are really reflecting that. Even, you know, house sizes are going down a bit. In Europe, they've been going down for a while. There's a tendency towards wanting more free time. I think even with the economic crisis, it's had a lot of people asking themselves, you know, really, what is the American dream and how can we redefine that?
But I just can't see the president of Citibank moving to a 12 by 12. Can you?
Well, you know, there's some interesting people even here in New York people from J.P. Morgan who have now started the Capital Institute, which is trying to get the absolute top CEOs to totally re-envision how we do capitalism based upon Shoemaker's idea of small is beautiful and everything like that. Also, even cities like Portland and Seattle are considering gross national happiness as a city policy. I think Vancouver is as well, as an alternative indicator to GDP. So there's a lot of people thinking in this direction.
William Powers is a writer and senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. He's the author of 12 by 12. Coming up, healing heartbreak and rediscovering hope on the Pacific Crest Trail. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Cheryl Strayed had hiked before. She'd gone camping, but she'd never backpacked by herself. That's just what she did for 3 months through largely uninhabited wilderness in the hope that it would help her come to terms with the unexpected death of her mother. Strayed writes about her time living alone in the natural world in her memoir, Wild. She told Steve Paulson that hiking the Pacific Crest Trail along the western coast of the United States was her way of dealing with loss when her life fell apart.
When I was a senior in college, my mother died very suddenly of cancer. She was 45 years old. She was a senior in college too, actually. And at that point, you know, my mother had been really my only parent. I didn't and still don't have a relationship with my biological father. And my life unfurled. My family, as you know, it really disintegrated in our grief. My siblings and my stepfather and I, even though we still loved each other, we couldn't really hold it together as a family. And so I lost a family, my family. I was an orphan in the world. I was married at the time that my mother died. I had gotten married very young. And in my grief and sorrow, I really couldn't sustain that bond, even though I cared for my husband deeply and loved him. In retrospect now, I can see that I was just self-destructing. I became very promiscuous sexually. I got involved with drugs, started using heroin. A boyfriend that I had connected with was a heroin addict, and I started using with him. And I was really doing a lot of things that were incredibly self-destructive. And so when I found myself at this moment, as you say, I was at the bottom. I was standing in line at an REI outside of Minneapolis. I was working as a waitress at the time, and there had been a blizzard, and I needed to dig my truck out. And so I went to buy a shovel. And talk about a metaphor. I had to dig myself out literally. And it was then that I just saw this guidebook. And like you, I'd not heard of the Pacific Crest Trail, but I saw this book that said The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. And I picked it up and read the back. And I was taken by the story of this trail.
Now, there is an art to doing this, I'm sure. I mean, everything from getting yourself mentally together to taking along the right stuff. I mean, especially if you are traveling alone, you have to carry all of your belongings on your back. How did you get ready?
Well, I got ready by buying a bunch of stuff. Like any good American. I really had never gone backpacking before. I'd gone hiking, I'd gone camping a lot, but always, you know, with my car or, you know, a canoe. But this was the first time I was carrying everything. And I really read that guidebook that I mentioned before. And I bought all the stuff that it said a backpacker needed. And I went to this little town of Mojave, California, where I really began my hike in the Mojave Desert. And I loaded all this stuff into my pack, and it ended up being quite a lot of stuff. Too much stuff, as it turns out. I wasn't really mindful of weight and thinking about what it meant to carry so much stuff through the wilderness. So I really had a lot to learn. My pack, I couldn't even lift it. The first day of my hike, I couldn't even lift it a hair.
You couldn't lift it off the ground.
I could not lift it. I could not budge it. I mean, it was just like trying to lift a Volkswagen Beetle. It looks like you can lift it, but you can't.
Okay, so you're standing in your motel room. You literally cannot lift the pack off the ground. And yet somehow you managed to put it on your back and hoist it up.
This is the paradox of the journey. You know, the big question I was asking, really, I think at that time of my life was, how do I bear this weight that I can't bear? How do I bear what's unbearable to me, the death of my mother and really the way my life had come undone? And so it was interesting, in the form of that backpack, I had that thing presented to me in a really practical and physical way. And so I did get that pack attached to my body. It wasn't pretty how I did it, but I did it. And I walked onto the trail. And so began my 94-day trek.
Well, and just the physical punishment you took sounds absolutely grueling. I mean, the blisters that formed on your feet, I mean, your toenails actually fell off. And then all that you had to do to make sure that you had enough to drink, for instance. I mean, you had to ration water at first because you were hiking through desert.
That's right. There was so much about the trail that was unexpected. But the physical trials were really, you know, so much greater than I had predicted. It's absolutely the hardest thing I've ever done physically. And there was a lot of pain involved. My feet never, even after being out there 3 months, my feet never really adjusted to the rigors of the trail. There was always another layer of skin that could be peeled off. My body was chafed from that very heavy pack. And then also just, I mean, I was essentially, you know, running a marathon, walking a marathon every day back to back for weeks on end through really rough terrain, going up and down mountains in all sorts of weather. You know, I went out there thinking I was really going on a spiritual journey. And I went out there and had a physical trial, and it ended up being incredibly spiritually transformative.
Because it was so physically grueling?
I think so. I think that there is some relationship between that physical trial and what we learn about ourselves inside. I mean, I think that's why people do things like when they're turning 50, they decide to run a marathon or undertake some new adventure that has a physical element at its core. And I didn't know that that's what I was seeking, but it was one of the most important things that I got. It really took me out of my emotions. I'm not somebody who really represses my emotions. And so I was so sunk into my grief and to my sense of myself, of having failed in my life, in my marriage, and in so many different directions, getting involved with drugs, all of those things. And so I actually didn't need to sink deeper into those emotions. What I needed is to be taken out of them and given a new perspective. And the physical demands of the trail made me do that. I had no other choice.
Now, you were making this hike alone, and there are not that many women who would take this on. And I assume you didn't see many other women hiking alone along the Pacific Crest Trail. Were you afraid?
I was afraid sometimes, but mostly what I was is insistent upon the fact that I was not afraid. And I had to do that before I went out there. I decided that there was no way I was going to be able to do this alone in the wilderness if I let my imagination run away from me and if I let myself believe the narrative that women are so often told, that, you know, we shouldn't do things alone, we shouldn't go places alone, that we'll be victimized in some way. And I know that that is a reality. And, you know, many of my friends have had hard experiences. But what I really felt is I wasn't going to let fear stop me from doing something that was important to me. And I'm so glad I didn't. So I just told myself I wasn't afraid.
What did you think about during all those times when you were alone, day after day?
I thought about everything. I mean, I thought about things I didn't even know I could think about. It was like, you know, things I thought I'd forgotten. I'd suddenly find myself down some lane, some memory lane, and I would be working through, I worked through every relationship in my life. I recounted childhood experiences in my mind. I thought about songs. I sang advertising jingles. They would haunt me, the things that I didn't even want in my head.
Now, there are a lot of times when we do mull over our life and, you know, think about things that have happened to us. And often it's just kind of a tape that keeps repeating in our heads. And it sounds like you did some of that, but you also resolved some of these issues or made sense of them in a way that you hadn't before. And I'm wondering how that happened.
It's a mystery. You know, I think that writing Wild was another layer of my figuring out what that trip meant to me. Writing gives you the opportunity to reflect deeply upon your experiences and what it means to be human and all of those big questions that we ask ourselves. And, you know, I think that on the trail, I learned how to accept the facts of my life and accept the conditions of my life acceptance was really so key. And every day I had to accept the trail. I had to accept that my feet hurt and I still had to walk 20 miles. I had to accept that I really wanted a cheeseburger and I wasn't going to get one. I had to accept that it was 105 degrees and the water in my water bottle was as hot as tea. And doing those things day after day in that very simple way that I had to do them, it really gave me a deeper sense of how to accept the world without my mother in it, how to accept the fact that the father I had is not the father I would have liked to have had. And those are big, hard things. And of course, it's not like I accepted those things and then went onward and never had to think about them again or heal them in my heart again. I have. And I think that that's what we do as we go through life. But I did it powerfully on the PCT in the summer of 1995.
Did you make it to your destination in the end?
I did. I finished my hike in the little town of Cascade Locks, Oregon, which is on the banks of the Columbia River. There's a bridge that spans the river, connects Oregon to Washington, that's called the Bridge of the Gods. And I can't think of a better place, a more poetic place to have ended my journey. And I walked up to it on September 15th, 1995. I touched my hand to the bridge. And then I walked down the street and got a really, really, really big ice cream cone and ate every bite. You know, so after that hike, I went off into my life and pursued my writing career with a passion and met a partner who I love very much. I'm married to my husband, Brian, and we have two children who are in kindergarten and first grade. And my life feels big and whole in a way that, you know, before, as I wrote in Wild, I felt like I was a woman with a hole in her heart.
Well, it sounds like you learned how to grieve for your mother on this trail, even though she had died, what, 4 years earlier?
Yeah. Maybe what I did is I learned how to come through maybe the most important stage of grief, which is acceptance, and which is acknowledgement that, you know, it will never be okay that my mother's dead. It will never be fine with me, but I can bear it. And we all have suffered, and we will all be made to suffer in some way in the course of our lives, and that we can go on with joy in spite of that. And I really came to grips with that on the PCT.
Cheryl Strayed lives and writes in Portland, Oregon. She's the author of Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website, ttbook.org, where you can also indulge your every listening whim on our interview archives. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Back to the Land Again. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamp, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.